I'm reading from the Message Bible, Genesis 42, verses 1 through 5. When Jacob learned that there was food in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you sit around here and look at one another? I've heard there's food in Egypt. Go down there and buy some so we can survive and not starve to death." 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to Egypt to get food. Jacob didn't send Joseph's brother Benjamin with them. He was afraid that something bad might happen to him. So Israel's sons joined everyone else that was going to Egypt to buy food, for Canaan too was hit hard by the famine.
Last week, Pharaoh had two dreams, and no one could interpret them. And that was a big problem for him because he knew they contained important information. So after none of his magicians and so on could do the work, they called for this Hebrew slave who was in prison named Joseph, hauled him out of prison, and lo and behold, he was able to interpret Pharaoh's dream. And the interpretation of the two dreams was the same, that very shortly there would be 7 years of great plenty in the land of Egypt. And then that would be followed by 7 years of severe famine. And it was a warning to get ready for what was to come, to take advantage of the 7 years of plenty so they could survive the 7 years of famine following that. Well, Pharaoh was so impressed that this young man had this interpretation that he said, "You know what? You're the guy who needs to supervise this whole operation." So he put Joseph in charge of the entire land of Egypt. There was only one person who had more authority in the land of Egypt, that was Pharaoh himself. And Joseph's job was to gather all the grain and all the corn and all the food that they could during the 7 years of plenty so that they would have enough to get through the 7 years of famine. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Things went really well in the land of Egypt for 7 years, and there was so much surplus that they just set it all aside. And at the end of the 7 years, things got really bad. And all of a sudden, people were starving, and they were hungry. And it wasn't just people in Egypt who were hungry. It was the whole known world. And so everybody was coming to Joseph to get food so that they wouldn't starve to death. And that's where we left it last time, where Joseph is now the man in charge of this whole operation that is basically saving the world from starvation. And Joseph's family back in Canaan are also feeling the effects of this famine. And that's where we're going to pick up the story in chapter 42, verse 1. It says, "When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, 'Why do you just keep looking at each other?'" All right, now Jacob has gathered his strength again. He's a leader again. And he's basically taking a swipe at his sons with this statement. He says, "You know, our family's in crisis, and what are you guys doing? You're just sitting there staring at each other. Why don't you do something?" It's kind of like if there's, you know, a financial crisis and someone says, "Quit staring at each other, do something, all right? We don't have forever. Someone has to take action." And so that's what Jacob says to his sons, "Guys, do something." And then he goes on to tell them in verse 2, he says, "I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." All right, we're at the point of starvation. You guys go to Egypt, get us some food. Because they have nothing to eat. Things are so bad, and otherwise death is imminent. So in verse 3 it says, "So then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brothers, with the others, because he was afraid that harm might come to him." All right, now it's pretty clear at this point that Benjamin, the youngest of all the 12 sons of Jacob, that Benjamin is now Jacob's new favorite. Joseph had been the favorite because he was the son of Rachel, and Rachel was Jacob's favorite wife. So when Rachel died, Jacob basically passed all of his affection on to Rachel's firstborn son, Joseph. But now Joseph is gone. And so Jacob has now passed all of his affection to Rachel's younger son, Benjamin. She only had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And so Benjamin is now the recipient of this favoritism and all of his father's love. And Jacob's favoritism is blatant to everybody. Just as it had been blatant with Joseph, now his favoritism with Benjamin is now very obvious. It's so obvious that Jacob is willing to send his other 10 sons on a dangerous mission, one where they might get harmed or they might get hurt or something bad might happen, but he's not willing to send Benjamin on a mission where he might get hurt. It's okay if the other son get hurt, but it's not okay if Benjamin gets hurt. And it leaves you wondering, what did the other 10 brothers think of Benjamin? They had hated Joseph because of their father's favoritism to him. What's to say they didn't hate Benjamin as well, for the same reason, for being their father's favorite? And you have to assume that maybe there was some resentment, at least to some degree, on their part toward Benjamin. It also makes you wonder if maybe Jacob was aware of that resentment that might exist. In fact, maybe he was afraid that the harm that might come to Benjamin was precisely the harm of sending him with his brothers. After all, the last time he had sent a favorite son with these 10 brothers, harm had come. And so maybe he realized it's risky business to send his next favorite son with the same group of guys. And all this goes to show once again, for probably about the 25th time now in the book of Genesis, that there's a lot of family dysfunction in this book. I've said this before, and it's a point that's worth repeating, and that is that family life is very, very difficult. The idea of the perpetually happy, loving, warm family is either completely untrue or almost completely untrue. Okay, it exists virtually nowhere. And it certainly doesn't exist here in the Bible, in the book of Genesis. And I think it's good news, because if the patriarchs of our faith, the fathers of our faith, if they had all these family problems, then maybe we're not so bad off either. I mean, they didn't know how to parent. They didn't know how to get along with people. They had all kinds of problems. And somehow God still had a place for them. He was able to use them. And so maybe you don't need to feel so bad about your own family dysfunction. I mean, if you have a child who needs to see a counselor once a week, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world, okay? If it happens to the patriarchs, it can happen to you too. And so I hope that you can actually gain some solace from the fact that the people in the Bible had really messed up home lives. And if that's your life, it's not over. God can use you too, just like he did the patriarchs. Family life is just difficult. And fortunately, the Bible doesn't try to hide that. We certainly see it in the family of Joseph. Verses 5 and 6. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Now this is an incredible moment in this story, because these brothers have arrived in Egypt, and upon arrival, they have gone to the governor of Egypt, the one who can give them food, and the first thing they do is they bow down to the ground with their faces touching the ground, and without even realizing it, they are fulfilling this dream of Joseph's that they absolutely despised. The dream where he saw his brothers bowing down to him in the form of grains of or sheaves of grain bowing down to his grain. You may remember that story from Genesis 37. And they hated him for that dream. And so here they are in Egypt. They don't recognize that it's their brother Joseph sitting on the throne, because he looks thoroughly Egyptian. And now they're bowing down to the ground, literally touching their heads to the ground in fulfillment of this dream. and they're doing it without even realizing it. And this has to be just an incredible moment for Joseph. You just have to wonder what is going through his mind as he sees this happening. Here are the men who wanted to kill him and took steps to kill him, who absolutely despised him, and now here they are bowing down to him just like he said they would, just like the dream said they would. And I've often wondered, what would I do if I were Joseph in this situation? Would I be rough on him? Would I make life difficult for these guys? Would I be kind to them? Would I forgive them? Exactly how, if I were them, what would I do? Would I gloat about the situation? Because, you know, it's just a total reversal. Here are these guys who wanted him dead now bowing down to him. I wonder if maybe some of you have had a situation like this where someone really mistreated you in the past. Maybe they said you'd never amount to anything or you'd never succeed or something like that. And then some point later, maybe several years later, they are there to witness your massive victory. My guess is that probably some of you have had that experience. And, you know, what is it like when the person who wronged you or predicted your demise is there to see you successful? What does that feel like, and how do you handle that? And a lot of what we're going to talk about today is how Joseph handled it. Well, these guys, these brothers of his, are completely at his mercy. He can literally do anything with them that he wants. And so I want you to notice what Joseph does. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Now, why does Joseph treat his brothers harshly or roughly? Why is he mean to his brothers? Well, there are several theories. One, probably the most obvious, is that he can't stand them. He absolutely despises them, and so it's a matter of revenge. These guys tried to kill him, and so it's understandable if Joseph doesn't mind seeing them suffer and hurt just a little bit. After everything that they put him through, he's going to get just a little bit of that back by being rough on them. Another theory is that it's because Benjamin wasn't with them. There were all 10 of them, but no Benjamin. And so maybe the thought that goes through Joseph's head is, I wonder what these guys have done with Benjamin. I know what they did with me. And what's to say they wouldn't do the same thing to my younger brother? If they would despise me and try to kill me, maybe they've done the exact same thing to Benjamin. And so he's worried, he's scared that they've harmed Benjamin. And so maybe that's why he was rough on them. And certainly he had every reason to believe that his brothers would do that to Benjamin based on their treatment of him. And then another option is that maybe he's testing them. Maybe he wants to see if they've changed at all. Are they the same guys they were 13 years ago who wanted him dead, or have they changed? And the only way he can find out if they've changed or not is by putting them through some hardship, really seeing if they're the same guys. And my guess is that there are elements of all three of those that are present here. There is an element of revenge. He doesn't mind seeing them squirm a little bit. I also think he truly was concerned about Benjamin, and I think he wanted to test him. And we're going to get into each of those a little bit more in just a minute. Verse 7, "So where did you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see where our land is unprotected." So Joseph asked where they're from. His brothers tell the truth. They say that they're from Canaan and they've come to buy food. And Joseph gives them a hard time. He accuses them of being spies. He says, "You've come to see our land in its state of nakedness. We're going through a famine right now, and you've come to see where we're most vulnerable so that you can pull off an attack somehow." That's what he accuses them. "You guys are spies." And it's interesting here because there's this theme in the story of Jacob over and over, and basically it's what comes around goes around. Back in Genesis 37, it says that when Joseph was young, he had reported some misdeed of his brothers back to their father Jacob, and they despised him for it. And no doubt that his brothers, as a result of that, had looked at Joseph as a spy for their father. And they had accused him of that. And so now it's interesting because now Joseph is turning the tables on them. "Just as you guys accuse me of being a spy, now I'm accusing you of being a spy." Verse 13, "But they replied, 'Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more.'" And that last part is actually kind of touching because the brothers are really being very honest here. They're not covering up anything. They're not leaving out any details. They don't know what happened to Joseph. They don't know for sure if he's dead or alive. They just know they threw him in a pit, and then he was gone. And so they say, "He's no more." Didn't say he's dead, just said he's no more. Now, can you imagine what it would have been like for Joseph to hear this? To hear these brothers recounting and actually referring to him and simply saying, "He's no more." It would have been very dramatic, very difficult for Joseph to still conceal his identity, I would think. But he manages to. And in verse 14, Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you. You are spies. And this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives," and that's a pretty big, what do you call it? Pretty big oath. As sure as Pharaoh lives, in the land of Egypt, that's about as big as oaths can get. "As sure as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." So Joseph sets up a test for his brothers. And he says that it's a test to see whether they're spies. But the truth is it's not a test to see whether they're spies. It's just a test to see whether they've changed. See whether they're still the same guys he grew up with. And so Joseph sets up the test this way. He says, "I'm going to keep all of you guys, all 10 of you, in prison, except for one. So I'm going to keep all 9 of you in prison, and I'm going to send one of you back home to Canaan. And I want that one to go back home and get your youngest brother Benjamin and bring him back here. And if you don't bring your youngest brother Benjamin back here, then I'll know that you guys have failed the test. I will know that you really are spies, and you will be my slaves for the rest of your lives here in Egypt." Now, the question is, how does this test prove whether they are spies or not? You know, go get your brother and bring him back. What does that have to do with whether they're spies? And the truth is, it has nothing to do with whether they're spies. He wants to see Benjamin, but he does it under the guise of accusing them of being spies. Joseph wants to know, have these guys changed? And he wants to know, what's the status of my younger brother Benjamin? Well, in verse 17, it says, and he put them all in custody for 3 days. And again, we go back to this theme of what comes around goes around. These brothers had thrown Joseph in a pit 13 years before. And now what does he do, first chance? He throws them in a pit for 3 days. He put them all in custody for 3 days, and on the third day, Joseph said to them, do this, and you will live, for I fear God. Now, the phrase, for I fear God, is another way of saying, I'm an honest person. He says, if you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison, while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die. This they proceeded to do. So he comes to them after 3 days in jail and he announces basically a test. And he says, basically, I'm changing the terms of the test. The new terms are only one of you has to stay in prison and all the rest of you go back to Canaan and feed your families and then bring your youngest brother back to me. So before it was all of you except one stay in prison. Now it's just one of you stays in prison and the rest of you go back. Now, the question is, why did Joseph alter the test? Why did he change it so that just one of them stayed in prison and all the rest of them went back home? I'm pretty sure that what Joseph is trying to do is he's trying to create a situation that is as similar as possible to the one that he was in 13 years ago. Because 13 years ago, the first chance his brothers got, they got rid of him, threw him in a pit, abandoned him, and he was taken away into slavery. And so now, what he's basically doing is he's giving these brothers another opportunity to abandon one of their brothers in a pit, basically. This brother's going to stay in prison. You guys go home. You're free to go. And the test will be, will you come back? He wants to find out, have these guys changed, or are they still willing to abandon one of their brothers in a pit in prison? And so these are the terms that he says up. And Joseph knows, if these guys never come back to Egypt, I'll have my answer. They haven't changed. And probably he'll never seek to have anything to do with them again. And then there's one other part of the test. This part has remained constant, and that is that they must return to Egypt with Benjamin. They can't just come back. They must come with Benjamin because, again, Joseph wants to see, how are they treating my younger brother? And there's only one way to find out. He has to see Benjamin for himself, and he has to watch how they interact with him. And so these are the terms that he sets up, and the brothers agree. In verse 21, they said to one another, this is the brothers, surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us. So the brothers begin to talk about why the governor of Egypt is giving them such a hard time. Why is this happening? And they speak in their own language, whatever it was, Canaanite or Hebrew or whatever their language was. They speak to each other in this language, thinking that Joseph can't understand them because everything was going through an interpreter. However, as these brothers are speaking, something very powerful is happening. Because by listening in on their conversation, Joseph still knows their native language. Joseph is seeing for the first time some signs that maybe, in fact, his brothers have changed. Because they look at their difficult situation and they attribute their plight to what they did to Joseph. This is happening because what we did to Joseph was wrong, and now we are paying the penalty for it. What they did was wrong, and they know it. And in a sense, they're accepting the responsibility for it. And there's one detail in particular that has not left their mind in 13 years since they did this to their brother. And that is Joseph's terror and his pleading with them not to hurt him. They have not forgotten that moment where he pled with them, he begged them, don't do this to me, and they did it to him anyway. And this is a new detail that has not been in the text up until now, is that Joseph pled with his brothers. And it really just serves to reinforce how terrible what they did to him really was. I mean, it's bad enough to harm someone like they did, but then to do it when the person pleads, when they beg for their life, and you do it anyway. And that's what they have done. And so Joseph overhears this. He says, wow, they attribute their hardship to what they did to me, and they haven't forgot what it sounded like when I pled for my life. In verse 22, they said to one another, surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life. Oop, that's not 21. 22, here we go. Reuben replied, didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen, and now we must give an accounting for his blood. Now, as you may recall, Reuben, who is the oldest son, had actually tried to stop the others from throwing Joseph in the pit. He had said, guys, don't do this. As much as we all can't stand our younger brother, we cannot throw him in a pit like this. We cannot kill him anyway. And later on in the story, as you may recall, Reuben was terrified when he realized that Joseph was gone. He was angry, he was terrified. He did not want harm to come to his brother, at least on their behalf. And now Joseph is hearing this detail for the very first time, that his oldest brother actually wanted to save his life and pleaded with the others not to harm him. And there is no doubt in my mind this was quite a revelation for Joseph to know that one of the brothers, the oldest brother, wasn't in on it, that he wanted him to be saved. All along, he thought all his brothers had conspired, and in fact, there was one who had not. And so in verse 23, it says, they did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep. Now, why did Joseph weep? Why did he just start crying? I think it's because he's overhearing his brothers talk. He's overhearing their conversation. And it's beginning to dawn on him that maybe they're sorry for what they did, and that they are in some way taking ownership for him. And I think that in particular he is touched by what Reuben said, by the revelation that his brother Reuben had tried to save him. That would be a very moving thing to find out that someone tried to do something good for you. It's an interesting question. What is it that brings humans to tears more? Is it great evil or is it great good? What causes you to cry? If you remember the story or the movie Schindler's List, that's been a while ago. But of course, in that movie, there was incredible evil that was shown. You know, bodies and just terrible things. But the most moving part of that movie for me was, at least in terms of on an emotional level, was not that, as terrible as that was. It was the very last scene in that movie where the survivors of the Holocaust and their families were taking stones and putting it on Schindler's grave, You remember that? To me, that was the most moving, that was the most emotional part, even more emotional than all the evil. And so I think Joseph here is really moved by the goodness of his brother. He didn't realize his brother had wanted to save him, and it brings him to tears. He's very touched by that. So Joseph had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack, and to give them permission of provisions for the journey. After this was done for them, he loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw his silver in the mouth of his sack. "My silver has been returned," he said to his brothers. "Here it is in my sack." Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other and trembling and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" Now, would you be terrified if, after making a purchase at the store, you found your money back in your wallet? Probably not. I doubt if you'd be terrified. So why were the brothers terrified to find their money that they had paid for the grain right there in the top of the sack? Why was that terrifying? Well, one possibility is that they thought, oh no, we're being set up. This governor of Egypt is one weird guy to begin with, and now he's setting us up. That's one possibility. The other possibility is really what the text actually says. He said, they said, "What is this that God has done to us?" In other words, the brothers say, uh-oh, we are now part of a divine drama that is going on. And this is so much bigger than us. And this situation is so out of control. What is it that God's doing, and what is it that God's going to do next? That would be terrifying. Verse 29. When they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them. They said, "The man who is lord over the land spoke harshly to us and treated us as though we were spying on the land. But we said to him, 'We are honest men, we are not spies. We were 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is no more, and the youngest is now with our father in Canaan.' And then the man who is lord over the land said to us, 'This is how I will know whether you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me and take food for your starving households and go. But bring your youngest brother to me so I will know that you are not spies but honest men. Then I will give your brother back to you, and you can trade in the land.'" You have to feel sorry for poor Jacob here. Every time his sons go out on a mission, they come back with one less. First time it was Joseph, now it's Simeon. And now they're asking permission already to go on another mission. And no doubt, there'll be one less son when that one is over too. You know, so you feel for this father. I mean, the last thing he wants his sons to do is go on another trip. You guys just stay here. At least we won't lose any more of you. But the sons want to go. They say, "We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to take Benjamin. We have to go back. That's the deal we made with this guy." Verse 37. Then Reuben said to his father, "You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you," talking about Benjamin, "entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back." So Reuben, the one who wanted to save Joseph initially, the oldest son, Reuben now makes a pledge to his father, and it's a pretty big pledge. He says, "Dad, put it all on me. If Benjamin doesn't come back, you can kill my two sons." Now, you have to wonder why a grandfather would want to kill two of his grandsons, but nevertheless, that's the pledge. He says, basically, it's a two-for-one deal. If Benjamin doesn't come back, you can have my two sons as collateral. And that's the offer. Verse 38, but Jacob says, "My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow. Basically, Jacob here is saying, Joseph and Benjamin are my two favorite sons. My first favorite son is now dead, and there's no way I'm going to lose my second favorite son, because I'd rather let Simeon stay in an Egyptian prison and die there than take the chance of Benjamin going and him dying. And so once again, you have this huge favoritism taking place. You know, this is, at least by our standards, this is not good parenting. And it's quite a statement on Jacob's part. But nevertheless, it's what's true. He's willing to give up Simeon as opposed to take the risk of losing Benjamin. And so Jacob refuses to allow his sons to go back to Egypt with Benjamin. He says, no, you guys are staying here. And next week we're going to see how Jacob's mind finally is changed and how what a major revelation takes place when these guys go back to Egypt. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this story. Sometimes it's hard for us to see ourselves in it. But we thank you for the themes and the messages of it. And we ask that you would go with us now this week. And if there's anything in this story that you want to remind us as we go about this week, anything that applies to our situation, I just pray that you would bring it back to our memory at the right time, and so that we would know your will and know what to do. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.